Hello, heroes, and welcome to a bonus episode of Critical Success. I'm real determined to keep Critical Success coming out every other week. Metatopia, the launch of Epiphany, and a couple of our other side projects threw a wrench into things last week, but I want to keep things moving forward. So, you're getting two episodes of Critical Success this week, so that we can resume a normal schedule. This week, I wanted to talk to everybody about alignment, which is something of a controversial issue in games. And by controversial, I mean these days I meet a lot of people who don't like it and don't like playing with it. To the point where a lot of people are wondering aloud on forum posts, why is alignment still a part of the game? Personally, I don't mind alignment. In fact, I think in a lot of situations it can be fun and interesting. Now, like all other opinions that I express on Critical Success, this is not the one and only way to play, and all other variations on alignment, either using it or not using it, are perfectly valid options. However, I'm suspect of throwing out anything that has the potential to make the game more interesting. So this episode, I'm hosting a discussion about alignment to try and tease out some of the aspects of it that I find interesting. And to help me, I've brought Ben Dutter, designer of the Vow of Honor role-playing system, onto the show. And without further ado, here's our talk on alignment. And here to discuss alignment with me today is Ben Dutter. Ben, say hi to everybody.
Hey, everybody.
Ben, you are a game designer and role player. How long have you been in the world of RPGs, role playing, GMing, that sort of thing?
I started playing about 20 years ago. I have a brother who's about 8 years older than I am, so I grew up in the heyday of early D&D and Advanced Dungeons and Dragons and trying to pester him to let me play with his much older friends. He was about 15 at the time. And so it just kind of grew organically from there, and I got hooked at a very young age. So
I don't understand how I ever have any credentials, because everybody I bring on the show has been gaming for so much longer than I have.
Well, to be fair, a lot of it was micro-focused in the kind of D&D trying to emulate Star Wars or trying to emulate Lord of the Rings for probably the first 15 years of that. So,
well, you know that, what? You know what? Don't talk about that like it's discounting what your experience is in RPGs, because that is actually something that a lot of game designers need, is to be able to look at a rigid system and make it stretch. It teaches an important lesson about how different mechanics can be applied and how you can play around with those to make them suit different things. Because a lot of designers that I really like to work with grew out of 3.5 in making it do things that it's not really suited very well to do.
Absolutely. My first hack was a 3.5 hack as well. And, you know, it was like so many fantasy heartbreakers at the time, and I don't view that as a derisive term or a negative term at all. I think that that's an important part of the game design sort of growth in this generation, in this era, is to sort of cut your teeth on how to make D20 or some other similar, you know, GURPS or something like that work for you from a different design perspective. And I was no different there.
Absolutely, especially in this era where heartbreaker does not mean financial heartbreaker. You sink a lot of time into it as opposed to pay for self-publishing costs, because you can just put out whatever idea you have as a PDF.
Exactly. And with Kickstarter or with other crowdfunding avenues, and then now the ease of print on demand and things like drive-through and RPG Now make it easier than ever to get your ideas heard, or even just a free WordPress blog or something like that.
Absolutely. And of course, the ubiquity of communication through forums and, you know, making your ideas reach people. But let's talk about the career of design at a later date. Right now, let's talk about why we have you on the show. And that is because you designed a game that is kickstarting right now called Vow of Honor. Mm-hmm. Why don't you give me the elevator pitch for Vow of Honor, just so we can bring everybody up to speed.
Vow of Honor focuses on playing a strict order of what are called arbiters. It's a pretty narrativist system, or a system that focuses more on story elements and kind of interesting motivation or character developments, rather than simulating every possible scenario. And that laser focus upon playing these arbiters allows me to incorporate alignment, or in this case, honor. The tenets of honor is a very strict code that the arbiters must follow. And so players take on the role of arbiters, and they live in this super post-apocalypse space station world that has sort of devolved into a medieval level of technology, and try to make it a better place.
Oh man, that's such a fun level. And correct me, is there magic in this system, or is it?
No, totally vanilla in terms of physics and everything. The only sort of things that the characters don't understand is there is some what I call forebearer artifacts or forebearer technology. Mm-hmm. It was the civilization that built Sasara, the world that the characters live on, and there's areas that they can't go due to lack of gravity or lack of oxygen, and they just call those areas the void lands or the ruins. So that's sort of the magic or the mystery, but it's to someone in modern time easily understood.
So this game is actually even more interesting than I thought it was originally when I decided to bring you on, because you are essentially, I mean, everybody can read between the lines there and see that this is a variation on Paladin and the rule structures that guide Paladin in gaming, not just in D&D, but across systems. There are plenty of systems that play with that sort of ideal, and most of them lean pretty heavily on magic, and we'll get into this in discussing alignment, but one of the things that interests me most about D&D philosophically is it's a universe where good and evil are measurable forces, and they can be demonstrated through a somewhat scientific process in the detect evil, detect good, and circles right. of protection. You are playing with Paladin alignment structures like the vows of honor in a world where there is no magic to bind anybody to their code.
That's correct.
So that's what made you want to latch on to that concept? What compelled you about that?
It's a long story, but basically I remember specifically when I was young, maybe 4 or 5, I saw Star Wars for the first time, episode 5, and we started right around the middle, and as I was watching it with my older brother, I found the duel between Luke and Vader just completely enthralling and mesmerizing. And, you know, for a young kid to see such a strong and clear delineation between good and evil made a definite clear impact on me from a creative standpoint, and that sort of propelled me into the whole world of what makes Luke a good guy, what makes Vader a bad guy, or even vice versa by some interpretations. And so that was kind of a over 20-year process or an obsession of what is morality, you know, what does honor mean, what are these different honor codes that have developed over the millennia, and how do we define that? And that's kind of all been boiled down and distilled into Vow of Honor. So I think that's the most interesting, meaty subject.
Wow, that is fascinating. I really like the idea of a role-playing game addressing that issue. I think questions of morality and what is morality, that's the sort of thing where the only space reserved for talking about that sort of thing is a philosophy class. Because almost any other circle where you would want to discuss that sort of thing, people hand wave it away because it's impractical to go, well, actually, what is good in a situation where you're trying to run a society and make sure that people aren't running around murdering each other? And most games, like if you look at video games, which arguably have had now versus RPGs, much more resources to develop different ideas and develop an artistic flavor to them simply because they're so much more ubiquitous and available than tabletop RPGs. The best morality system they have is like giving you points towards good and evil, and it's such a binary world. Or when it's non-binary, you have good, evil, and snarky as your three potential
right.
alignments.
Yes, like Mass Effect's renegade system. And you know, it's like just your attitude is what impacts whether you're a good guy or a bad guy or not.
Exactly. So rather than running away from that, you've decided to take this really heady struggle and put that into a role-playing system where it is a safe space to explore that in an interesting way. So that is why you are here, because
Definitely.
You care about that. So let's jump into it. Alignment.
Sure.
It is something that a lot of gamers do not like, and a lot of the criticism that I have seen of 5th edition, like Mike Merles not too long ago on Reddit did an AMA, and one of the mm-hmm. top-rated questions for this guy who did a nearly impossible feat in designing a D&D system that could potentially appeal to anybody who has come in at any edition of D&D, The top question to him is, why do we still have to deal with alignment? Isn't that right. boring? I have some problems with this, obviously, if you can't tell by the tone of my voice. So let's discuss a little bit of the value of alignment. What do you see as valuable in the alignment system? Why is it around?
Well, I think originally, and it kind of harkens back to mythology and the same sort of chords that are struck by movies like Star Wars or similar tales that were inspired by the heroic journey, so forth, are because in our world it is difficult to assign what is good and evil. It's definitely a gray area. And so being able to explore that in a very stark way, especially through like a role-playing game or through a book or a movie, makes it easy to say, I am a good guy and I'm doing good things. Look, here's my list of good things that I've done, and the book says that this is good. And so being very, very clear and very heavily contrasted on what those good and bad things are from a system standpoint, and then making that in the universe to be very clear as well. Like you said, there's kind of a scientific approach in the shared Dungeons and Dragons mythos that you can detect someone who's evil. It's a palpable physical force in the universe. That makes it very easy for people to play a good guy, and it makes it very easy for the GM to throw bad guys at them and not feel bad for killing a whole village full of orcs because, you know, they're chaotic evil. So I think it provides an easy platform to sort of interface with.
Right, right. I mean, that is the conceit of pretty much anything that shows up in any story, and that's storytelling economy. If we had to take the time and explain every small aspect of our universe, nobody would listen to any story that has to be told because it would be too much ridiculous nonsense to get through in order to hear a very simple story.
Exactly.
So hand-waving away good and evil and saying, no, there is good and there is evil and they're very clearly defined allows somebody who's sitting down to their first session of Dungeons and Dragons get behind their level one fighter and kill a goblin without, you know, carrying the same baggage that you would carry in real life if you had to kill another sentient being.
Exactly.
Yeah, it makes it a very complex issue very simple. Now, like right there, if you're a listener who does not like alignment, you might be listening to that and going, well, what you've just done there is taken something that could be complex and interesting and made it simple. Isn't that bad, especially for narrative? And I would say that it depends on what kind of story you're trying to tell. Sure, there are plenty of wonderful stories that are caught up in discussing, you know, the gray areas of morality. But that's definitely not useful for every story. And if you're going to lean too heavily on that element, your game is going to feel samey. Or it's because we're not going to solve any philosophical question at the table. It's going to be a drag because the game isn't going to move anywhere. There's not even a round that will pass. You'll be sitting there with your sword in your hand wondering whether it's a good idea to kill a goblin or not.
And I think that's a clear distinction to make. And I think that sets up a lot of the upfrontness that I have with my games as a designer and my games, even just when I'm playing with my friends at the table. You know, look, is this going to be something that's like Conan, or is this going to be something that's like Star Wars? You know, is there a clear evil force in the universe, or is it morally gray and we're all kind of anti-heroes doing what's best for us? And so I think that setting that expectation for that creative space, especially when it's improvisational with a group of people, is really important. So yeah, I think it's crucial dependent upon what type of story you're trying to tell.
So let's take it to its base level. If we go to OD&D and we think about like the basic moral quandary that gets posed to players when you actually think about the game a little bit, it's you're destroying some goblin town because they've been raiding human villages nearby, and you've cut through the warriors, and all that you have left is your goblin civilians, goblin children, goblin cobblers, goblins who are not, you know, involved in the raiding and the pillaging so much, but the creature itself is aligned evil. And you as a player know that no matter, like, if you let these goblins go, because they're aligned evil, the likelihood is that they're going to come back. Or even just them existing as evil creatures means, however that goblin cobbler is going to cobble, he's going to cobble in an evil way. That's just, that's who he is.
Yes, exactly.
So because that seems a very simplistic view of narrative, I think there's so much in there that is interesting inherently. Ben, why do you find that interesting?
As a young player and longtime player, you know, that question was posed many times, and there's a lot of ways that you can kind of narratively separate yourself from that. You can kind of fade to black as the party descends upon the village when all the warriors have been slain, or you can do what, like Peter Jackson did with Lord of the Rings trilogy, and made Uruk-hai and orcs not actually born in any kind of empathizing way. They, you know, they are construct almost. They just kind of sprout from the earth as adult males, and so it's easy to not pity them because they're just kind of a non-sentient force of destruction. And so there's ways that you can kind of get around it, but if you ever are confronted with that goblin cobbler, as you said, you know, who's just trying to feed his family or whatever, I think that's very interesting, and that space is the space that I've long tried to explore, and I've played countless thousands of hours probably as paladins and clerics and monks and you know, barbarians who have a strict moral code and the code of the hunter and all these different moral headspaces that you can get in that are really interesting. And but it is always difficult when you're trying to interface with that and it doesn't match with the kind of story that you're trying to tell. So that's what, like I said before, I think it's really important to preface the game or any sort of creative endeavor with, this is what we're trying to explore.
I really like that for a bunch of reasons, because no matter what decision gets made in that moment, it is an interesting choice.
Definitely.
If you kill the goblins because they're evil, you might do something and then have your character not feel good about it. And that creates such a fascinating conflict. I mean, the reason that any vow exists in any game is so that occasionally it gets challenged. And ultimately, because of the conceit of the class, you might have a character time and time again standing behind those morals and themes that are at the core of the character. But that's not boring, because superhero comics are doing quite well, and they are built around that premise. Or you do have the situation where the paladin walks away from their god and everything they've devoted their life to because of some higher internal morality.
Right, and I think both of those directions are easy to empathize with. Of course, you know, at least I do, and I feel like a lot of people feel this way, they like to connect with that hero, that triumphant person who is able to maintain their principles even when it would be much easier to forsake them. So that side of the coin we like to empathize with and have some, you know, shared feeling with that character. But on the flip side, we can also understand if that character forsakes their vows or makes an exception because, you know, as humans we're not perfect and we make mistakes, or there might even be a greater good, as is the common lexicon, is, you know, well, what's the greater good? Do you allow the sick people to come inside of your city because they're going to die outside and possibly infect the city? Or do you let them die outside? You know, it's always sort of those moral conundrums that I think are interesting to explore, just as much as the superhero concept of someone who never bends their morals.
One of the reasons I like alignments is they ultimately add gravitas to the game in a very simple way, because if you think of the different adventures that you're going on as different expressions of how your alignment is fulfilled or not fulfilled, you add this major theme that has been recurring again and again throughout fiction since the origin of human fiction. You are lending some sort of thematic importance to your character. So just by applying the alignment system to your character and deciding to play it, you've tied your character into themes that are big and that can be a lot of fun, so long as you don't sit on the sidelines, cross your arms, and question why you would want to play that.
Exactly.
I really want to know, in Vow of Honor, because the conceit of the game is different, tough moral choices, is there any mechanic that's supporting alignment? And how did you decide to have that interact in a non-magical world where a character isn't suddenly going to lose their magic powers because they haven't fulfilled their alignment?
There is definitely, most of the system is built around that. You know, the simple way that it's measured is from the perspective of the arbiters, and that's how I have to preface it, because it's not necessarily undeniably true to everyone in the universe, but it is definitely true from the perspective of the characters who have been indoctrinated and who have been not necessarily brainwashed, but who believe vehemently that they have the code correct, that this is the one true way, is what I call it, in their universe, in Sasara, of how to be honorable and how to be good. And so to them, anything else is considered outside of that spectrum. And so I'd say probably about a quarter of the book discusses what the tenets of honor and different actions that adhere to those tenets or violate those tenets, and pose different scenarios and where those tenets are applicable either way. And so the characters, the basic mechanic is the characters have a dice pool that they roll in order to succeed in any sort of task or combat or what have you, and they get more dice based upon their actions. So the longer and the more stalwartly they have adhered to their tenets, the more honor dice that they get to roll, and then they have to spend those dice in order to accomplish things. So it's a constant struggle to motivate them to maintain those tenets and not always take the easy way out. Now, the flip side of that is when they do run out of honor dice, how do they continue to succeed? And they become more desperate, and they start either doing things dishonorably, which allows you to sort of circumvent a lot of challenges. Why not just lie to the guard rather than try to convince him, etc.? And those are the interesting scenarios, and that's what the entire system is built around, to try to force that question.
Oh, that is interesting. I really like that, because boiling your game down to brass tacks, conviction is a superpower only as long as you continue to challenge that conviction.
As long as you are in scenarios where your vows are questionable or possibly violated, are when you will gain strength. So, yes, boiling it down to its most core fundament, that would be the true core element of the game.
And if you're looking at this from the perspective of alignment is boring or stupid, from a game design perspective, you see right here the construction of this game has made it so that thinking about alignment and discussing alignment creates infinite adventures. And I think a lot of people who find frustration in alignment because they think it's holding them back. And I think about any element in a game that restricts choice is something that I think about like a haiku. A haiku is a form that is incredibly restrictive. However, clearly from the massive catalog of haikus that have been written both in English and other languages, it's clear that there's a lot of creativity that can have wiggle room within those very restrictive borders. And this is a game that is fueled by an engine of those restrictive situations.
Definitely. And I've played, you know, D&D and other games like Pendragon is another good example, where if the group decides collectively to focus on that restriction, you get a much more cohesive game. And that's where we're starting to see the game design development and sort of the evolution of the industry is towards these micro games or these niche games where it scratches the particular creative itch rather than, you know, the kind of quote unquote kitchen sink systems and generic systems like GURPS and, you know, systems that try to simulate everything rather than give you a specific gameplay experience or a specific story experience. And, you know, even in D&D, if you have a group of paladins who all are lawful good, that's going to be a much different game than a group with one paladin, one fighter, one wizard, and, you know, one barbarian who all have different alignments, and the paladin is always trying to kind of, you know, steer the party towards his one true way. And that's where that conflict arises, because you have characters that have, you know, arguably diametrically opposed views. But putting those constraints on it and saying, no, everybody has to be good, or everybody has to be lawful, or something, you know, similar with traditional alignment systems, creates for a really interesting game dynamic. And that's kind of what led to Vow of Honor's conceptually.
So by removing a conflict that traditionally exists in a game where you have characters who aren't bound by a certain law clashing against characters who are, by removing that conflict entirely, you have actually opened up your game to a whole host of discussion that most likely wouldn't pop up in other games.
Yeah, definitely. And that was the whole point, was how do I create a cohesive party that can all be good guys, by their own perspective at least, all work towards a similar goal, but have different focuses within that goal. And that's where the different focuses on the different tenets and the different vows that you can take in the game. And there's, like, in D&D, you know, there's all the vow of poverty rules and these specific sub-alignments and things that you can get where it's slight alignment variation. That's the interesting part, not just, well, this is good or this is evil. It's the subtle differences that creative restriction applies that I think makes the interesting questions, makes everybody a lot closer, so the spectrum is more nuanced.
Now that we've sort of covered that things like lawful good are not one note, even if they appear one note, it might be that they appear one note because you have had them have to take a particular stance in your party or in your games in the past, and they haven't had the room to breathe to live up to their full potential. Let's discuss situations where we have mixed alignment parties. Because the first party that I really played in, you know, considering the character and playing the game, was with my creative partner, Kat Murphy, and she played a neutrally aligned wizard that did not believe in alignment, and did not believe in gods, which in D&D is a really interesting choice because gods demonstrably exist. Like, they're clearly there.
Exactly.
What do you think of playing games like that, where you have mixed alignments, and it is easy to call into question the rigidness of a certain character's behavior? Role-playing choices can easily be stunted in that sort of situation. What do you do in that sort of situation, especially because you've been thinking about it your entire role-playing career?
Well, I think that, first of all, and this is a major issue in all sort of group collective things, is you have to differentiate or separate yourself from the role-playing experience. It can feel very personal and it can feel very subjective and intimate, but you have to remember that and make it very clear, and I always preface it extremely clearly at the beginning. This is a game, you know, we're playing characters. These opinions may not be opinions that we share in real life, so explore that space. And I tend not to shy away from it because I trust my players to explore it interestingly. And even if the party collapses, I don't think that that is necessarily a negative thing. Now, if you're all playing a beer and pretzels game where you just want to go in and kill some goblins, then perhaps alignment can give a backdrop for why they're doing things. If a character is neutrally aligned, perhaps you're doing it for the loot, you know, that they're getting gold at the end of the dungeon. If a character is good aligned, well, the monsters are evil. And in like a D&D universe, they're demonstrably evil. Definitely palpably evil. And so that character may even sacrifice their earnings for the loot so that they can have an opportunity to kill more monsters. And so, you know, you have to explore that space of why different people or different motivations are working towards the same goal. And that can kind of fall on the shoulders of the GM or the group in an out-of-character stance of, well, how is this plot line going to work towards us all working together? And I think that's the issue that comes up, is a lot of people sit down at the table with, you know, five different characters, five different motivations, five different alignment systems, and the GM just starts them in a tavern with no real reason to work together. And that's the big hiccup. And then that's where, well, hey, you know, Bill is playing his lawful good cleric stick in the mud character, and he's trying to heal the dead goblin over here. You know, why you got to be a buzzkill? But if Bill and the group had discussed that ahead of time, that issue wouldn't have happened. You know, that would have been made clear from the get-go.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. Now I sort of want to talk, because like the neutrality clashing with good or lawful good is sort of the most bland form of it, because a neutral character, I feel like any party that has a neutral character who is stubborn about being neutral eventually sort of careens toward good, ultimately, because the description that I don't remember where I heard it, but I love it, of neutrality, is that neutral characters don't care very much about good and evil. However, they would rather have good neighbors than evil neighbors because they're easier to deal with.
Right.
Like Beer and Pretzels games, especially, this has come up, where anytime nobody has put any thought into party dynamic or characters before the game, and everybody created their character in a vacuum and showed up to game, because we're nerds, I think there's almost this fetishistic view of evil and villainy, mainly because a lot of villains that we see in various types of media are outsiders, and for some reason, as nerds, we feel that very much. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who really want to play evil characters, and they come to the table with evil characters. And all of a sudden, you have characters who might be good and might be evil and have to operate within the same party.
And I think that's okay. In fact, some of my fondest gaming memories, especially during my 3.5 days when I was really tweaking the system a lot and designing the very early foundations of what would become Valve Honor years later, was, you know, what does it really mean to be evil? And in D&D, if you take the stance that evil is like the book says, and you are a force for evil, then something greater than your evil motivation for destruction and corruption has to exist. And that's usually either they're selfish or they're manipulative, and they may even seek things that are beneficial to them because they want to live in a world that's not burnt to the ground. And so you can have these stances from these evil characters, like, you know, you could argue that a lot of characters, like the Emperor, you know, in Star Wars, mm-hmm. is a perfect example. He's definitely evil, but he didn't destroy the galaxy. He definitely controlled everything. He pulled the strings to become more powerful himself, but many of the citizens' lives did not change. And so you can have these characters that maybe want to pursue some lofty goal and are evil and will go about whatever they can do to accomplish it, but one of those things might be doing good things in the interim so that they can get a powerful group of allies, or that they can get some interesting piece of magical artifact or whatever.
That's a fascinating description of the Emperor, especially because his big end game was apparently building a gigantic murder ball that could blow up planets that he didn't want to destroy the galaxy or wouldn't.
Well, but to be fair, the Death Star was built specifically for fear, and he talks about this multiple times, and you know, the different Moffs and Tarkin and everybody talks about it. They say that the planets won't oppose them because they're afraid. They don't say we're going to use it so that we can disintegrate every planet. It's we only want to disintegrate our enemies and make a peaceful empire. And many real world governments have operated at that same kind of paradigm. And so I don't know if that's, and he's often lauded as one of the most evil fictional characters in history. So my point is to show that even someone who is irredeemably evil as the Emperor can be twisted in such a way to work with some good guys in the interim.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, I would love to talk about Sith philosophy specifically, because Kat Murphy, again, to reference her, because any discussion of good and evil in games really becomes interesting around her. She is adamant that Sith philosophy is not specifically evil. It's just very easy to make it evil because the Sith want to be the gods of their own universe. That is the central conceit of anybody that fell to the Sith in the Star Wars canon. They wanted to control the universe in a way that they couldn't, so they sought out the power that would give them the control. No, go ahead.
No, I'm just agreeing. I think that that's an accurate description. Now, when you refer to Star Wars canon, we can go down a deep rabbit hole with that since Disney took over. But yeah, I agree. In a vacuum, that's probably an accurate description of what leads people to the dark side more often than not.
And if you balance that against what we see as the basic motivation of any adventuring party in a role-playing game, they are there really to just seek power. Because the two carrots that they dangle in front of players are leveling up and acquiring loot. That is what almost every exactly. game is chasing after. You're never, I would love to play in the game where you're trying to become weaker and give away your money. That would be a ridiculous amount of fun, but most games are built on that natural, no, you're here to acquire power and indulge that power fantasy, which is so closely tied with making evil choices.
And I think that that's where sort of the separation comes in and the expectation comes in from a lot of the players is they're seeking this power fantasy. And a lot of these people, myself included, like the idea of, well, I'm a regular Joe Schmo living on Earth. What would it be like to be an all-powerful wizard or an all, you know, glorified warrior or hero or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And so getting that means to an end is sort of allowed so that, yes, we can pursue this sort of machination that we want to achieve. And I think that's a difficult thing to take on in most D&D games and similar, because the way that the characters are presented often without party cooperation and the GM setting it up a lot beforehand is that everybody, you know, are murder hobos. And I don't really like to use that term, but that's sort of the nomenclature that has sprung up from this concept. And I would argue that most adventuring parties, especially from an OSR standpoint, could be seen almost strictly as evil. And, you know, they're trying to get, like you said, loot or power or some combination thereof, and that's it. And so when you have that one oddball character who sticks out like a sore thumb, who isn't trying to pursue those two things, that's where you get that clash, and that's where that boredom or that sort of sensitivity comes in into the party. And in Vow, what I've done is an advancement and leveling up is specifically based upon a character's adherence to their code. So you have to observe all five of the tenets twice in order to level up. I call it advance in the game, but it's essentially leveling up. And that forces that carrot of they're not trying to get money. They're not trying to get more powerful. They're trying to do actions that are good so that they can become more enlightened or more attuned with the one true way.
That's really interesting. And what I think is most interesting about that sort of, I guess, impetus for adventure or, you know, pathway to advancement is that you have chosen for your setting what is essentially a post-apocalyptic setting. And it's no secret that post-apocalypse is the setting of this millennial generation. Every other game is a zombie game. Every other movie is a zombie movie. Zombie television shows on TV are doing quite well. Like the teen, what used to be teen interest romance books are now about post-apocalyptic civilizations where teenagers are either fighting to take down governments or fighting against each other or some combination thereof. You've taken this setting that is really supposed to be about the breakdown of morality, because almost every single post-apocalyptic narrative has our hero at some point be forced to make a decision that is aberrant. You've taken that and you've been like, no, let's try and keep moral even in this situation.
Yeah, and I actually sort of developed it backwards, and to be a stickler, Sestara, I don't think is necessarily traditional, and that's a silly word, but traditional post-apocalypse. And it means that it's many, many generations after the apocalypse. So it's post-apocalypse. And the point of that is, why would the Order of Fasan, as it's called, why would the Arbiters come to exist? They wouldn't ever have come to exist if society was great. And in the future, the Vow of Honor's base setting, it used to be great, and there was no problem for them to have to worry about. And then whatever happened, happened, and here we are thousands of years later, where humanity has been forced to become extremely brutal and extremely pragmatic. and to do whatever is necessary in order to survive and to protect their family. And so where is that moral foundation? And out of that natural sort of ethical channel that I think is inherent in all people, that is what created the order. So I sort of worked backwards, and I thought, why would this group of, you know, honor-bound knights exist? And they exist because their world is so tough and because so many people have foregone morality. And so they have to stand as a unified force against what they view to be evil.
Yeah, in a world where Superman murdered somebody in his most recent movie, I love the idea of coming up from the darkest depths and being like, no, let's establish our order of good and rightness in the shambles of society.
Exactly. And that's, you know, where post-apocalypse, I think it's tread the same ground. And it's interesting because that ground is pretty fresh in terms of, you know, the long scope of narrative. But in recent times, it's what's interesting to me, at least, and with Vow of Honor trying to explore, is what happens to the society after those people have made those terrible, moral, aberrant choices. And what are the effects of that after 5 generations or 10 generations? You know, what impact did that have on society? And a great book, which I'm sure many of our listeners have read, is, you know, the Ender's Game series and the Ender Shadow series. And that's been a big impact to me and inspiration to me. And Ender made the choice unknowingly to, a spoiler, I hope no one doesn't mind, to, you know, wipe out another sentient species. And the next sequel of the book explores how galactic society has been impacted by that choice and how they view Ender thousands of years later. And so that sort of was a subconscious trigger for me to explore in Vow of Honor is, you know, yeah, our great-great-grandfather had to kill a bunch of people in order to make us live, and we respect that, but now let's try to put society back together again.
Okay, so we've pretty much covered, you know, your OD&D stories, your stories, where we're exploring the narrative, of good versus evil. The other aspect of alignment, that not a lot of people talk about except in stories that are built around it is chaos versus order. Cause we've got a 9-point alignment grid. What are your feelings on order and chaos? Because I know plenty of people who think order and chaos is the more important struggle.
Yeah, and I think that if you really go into depth with alignment, you start to get blurry. And, you know, it becomes, well, what's the difference between neutral good and lawful good? Or, you know, are there even multiple shades of neutral good, etc.? And so with law and order, I think it's the pull that people have of independence versus assimilation or integration into society. And there's this sort of, especially in America and in modern society, there's this sort of pull towards independence where it's viewed romantically of everyone can be an entrepreneur, including myself. I'm kickstarting my own game, of course. You know, everyone can do what they want to do. Everyone has equal rights. And that is being viewed, that chaos is being viewed as a good thing. But at the same time, law and order is important to maintain that infrastructure to allow someone to be independent or to allow someone to function without having to worry about the bare essentials. So I think that law and order are not so much opposite ends of the spectrum in alignment as they are in terms of sort of interwoven with one another. So I think it's an interesting thing to look at, and especially in D&D, but it's not so much black and white, like good and evil is.
I love that you talk about them as interwoven with one another, thinking about a yin-yang situation as that is sort of the position of anybody in history who has thought about it. Yes.
Yeah, definitely agree. And, you know, so I think that D&D trying to posit or any alignment system that uses a diametrically opposed scale of law versus chaos or whatever is not really well thought out. And I think that's one of the big issues with the Dungeons and Dragons traditional 9-point alignment system is that people have different definitions of law and different definitions of chaos. And they're supposed to be these very concrete things in the universe. You know, someone there's an axiomatic greatsword that, you know, smites those who believe in chaos. And so you really need to define what your table's version of that is, I think, to explore that properly.
That is true. But, you know, at the same time, I can push back against that and say good and evil can be just as vague as, you know, in OD&D, we're talking about killing a village full of children that have done nothing wrong in their lives simply because you have hard declared them evil. And if we think about one of the most alignment enigmatic figures that gets brought up in memes all the time, Batman in Chaos versus Order, you have somebody who steps outside the law in order to enforce the law. The ultimate American power fantasy is
yes.
Still having laws while not having laws. I wouldn't say that Chaos versus Order, at least to me, is a weak definition for alignment. I'm not sure I fully buy that. I do think it is harder for people to understand at face value, though.
Right. And I don't think it's necessarily a weak opposition by any means. I think that it's harder in Western society for us to define well. And, you know, even within, like you said, with Batman as a perfect example, you know, you could argue, well, Batman is upholding the laws as they should be. You know, the moral laws, or he's upholding the laws and the police are corrupt and not upholding the laws. So even though he is going against the police, who are the authority figures, the lawful figures, their version of law is bad. And so his version of law is the right one. And so, you know, you get this, you start slicing and having this kind of crazy amount of nuance between all the different flavors. And that's what I meant more, that it's harder to define, I think, for most of us, like you said, at face value. So I don't think it's weak. I think it's totally worth exploring. And honor, you know, binds that up. Does lawfulness include keeping your oaths? I think so. You know, if you're constantly breaking your vows, is that something that's chaotic? Well, maybe it's good, though. You know, so there's definitely room to explore all that, and it's definitely interesting.
So I think the last thing that I sort of want to touch on, is something that Chris Sims, who's been a guest on One Shot before, and he talks a lot about comic books. One of the things that annoys him most about the current DC universe is that in 3 years of the New 52's continuity, he argues that we have not had a major plot line about good guys fighting bad guys. And we have had these sort of deconstructionist plot lines where the lines are blurred, where our traditional villains are, you know, fighting other worse quote-unquote villains, and Lex Luthor has joined the Justice League, and the baseline of this comic book universe, which is ostensibly about good and evil and black and white, is now really jumbled and isn't directed because there's no baseline morality established. And I would say to gamers who are frustrated and feel restricted about alignment in their games, alignment is what makes questioning alignment interesting. And without that, there's no point in your intellectual pursuit of good and evil.
Yeah, definitely. I think, like you were talking about, the creative constraints earlier, and what makes Star Wars and similar stories, you know, traditional Superman, so compelling is that people like good guys and people like the good guy winning. And, you know, with my own game, Vow of Honor, I say right on the Kickstarter page, I built the game so that you can play a good guy and not feel bad about it. But you can also wonder what it means to be a good guy. And so I think that's an important step in the kind of exploration of what it means to be good or a hero. And sometimes alignment is a perfect way to scratch that itch of I am lawful good. We are a party of lawful good characters. Let's go take down the evil overlord and his chaotic evil minions. And that's a perfectly acceptable way to approach that game concept.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about this subject, which I'm sure long after this discussion is going to plague gamers and make them argue with each other. You are currently working on the Vow of Honor Kickstarter, which is kickstarting right now. Do you know what's your current level of funding at? How far do you have to go?
I'm about 60% funded in the first week. Today was day number 7, so it's looking good. We're hoping to have full funding here in the next couple of weeks so that we can start knocking down those stretch goals, and I encourage anyone to go and look at some of the gameplay examples and read more on the Kickstarter page if you want to check it out.
And what do people need to get the PDF? What's the...
The $10 pledge level gets you the PDF, full color, illustrated, and we're working on doing an EPUB and Mobi conversion for that as well, so you can look at it on your favorite tablet or phone with very simple conversions. And I do plan on eventually releasing those to the public after everything is said and done.
So I think for anybody out there who is interested in this discussion or has really strong feelings about alignment, whether for or against it, $10 is not much to have a game that mechanizes alignment. So if, like any other thing in games, I think about things when there is some sort of mechanical reason to make me think about it and incentivize me. It might not be a bad idea to just, you know, give it the $10 level if you weren't thinking of giving before and get this game so that you can tear into it and help formulate your ideas about this issue. I think there's plenty of adventure seeds that we touched on in this talk, and I think there are plenty of adventure seeds that we didn't touch on. So if you're a GM, pick up that book. Even if you never play the game, it is going to make your games more interesting just by giving you new ideas.
Well, that's a ringing endorsement if I've ever
heard. Ben, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
Definitely. Thanks for having me, James.
Well, heroes, that's Critical Success for today, but we will be back on Thursday with another episode that will include some of my thoughts about Metatopia. Don't forget to check out the other fine one-shot related programming. That's One Shot dropping every Monday, Campaign dropping every Wednesday, and of course, Critical Success, which comes out every other Thursday. If you want to find out more about One Shot and our side projects, including the impending public beta test of Epiphany, check us out on Twitter at OneShotRPG, our Facebook group at facebook.com/OneShotPod, our Google Plus community, or communicate with Kat directly on Tumblr at oneshotpodcast.tumblr.com. If you have a question for Critical Success and you would like it answered on air, email us at gamemaster@oneshotpodcast.com. Be sure to include Critical Success in the title. I want to be perfectly clear, there is no such thing as a one-shot secret archive. I don't know where this rumor started, but somebody's been going around the internet saying that there's some stockpile of secret episodes of One Shot that never made it to air. And in fact, Kat, I, and the others have been slowly growing it over time to include hours of content that you haven't heard yet. It's simply not true, and we're definitely not going to announce a way to access it in the next couple of months. Don't wait around for it. Don't search for secret clues in the episodes, because we deny the existence of a secret archive vehemently. It does not exist. It will never exist, and don't follow us on our various social media accounts to find out about it. Also, while you're not searching episodes for secret clues to find the secret archive, I wouldn't start searching at episode 73 of One Shot. Why would we put a secret clue at episode 73? That makes absolutely no sense. Listen to yourself. You're out of control! And the very idea that we're also lacing in secret clues in upcoming episodes of Campaign is preposterous. Do you hear me? Preposterous! I have had it with your infantile obsession with secret episodes that may or may not include unreleased episodes of Star Wars that we recorded and got corrupted and couldn't release, so we had to record the entire thing over. Does that even sound like that could possibly be a real thing? Who would do that? You know what? I'm getting really emotional here. I'm going to calm down and end the episode right now, but next time, I expect you to come back with a more reasonable outlook on these secret episodes. They don't exist, and be sure to tell everybody that you know that loves One Shot that these episodes don't exist, okay? One Shot is a joint production between Tenpenny Press and Peaches and Hot Sauce. Peaches and Hot Sauce is a Chicago-based comedy network with tons of great articles, videos, and podcasts for you to enjoy at peachesandhotsauce.com. Finally, that music, which is right now swelling up over my voice, is Be Your Own Pet with Adventure, courtesy of Infinity Cat Records. See you next time, heroes!